When it comes to ensuring your company has top-notch security practices, things can get complicated fast. With Vanta, you can automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, HIPAA, and more. Vanta's market-leading trust management platform can help you unify security program management with a built-in risk register and reporting, and streamline security reviews with AI-powered security questionnaires. Over 7,000 fast-growing companies like Atlassian, Flow Health, and Quora use Vanta to manage risk and prove security in real time. You can watch Vanta's on-demand video at vanta.com/decoder to learn more. That's vanta.com/decoder.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Hello and welcome to Decoder. I'm Neil Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, and Decoder is my new podcast about big ideas and other problems. On today's episode, I'm talking to Charlton McIlwain, a professor of media, culture, and communications at NYU, and the author of Black Software, The Internet and Racial Justice from the Afronet to Black Lives Matter.
There's a story here that goes well beyond our current moment, way back into the very earliest parts of computer networking, where Black people were very much connected and a part of that story, and yet that story had been largely untold.
As we've gone through the pandemic, I've been really thinking about how much of our lives are now happening on screens and through software. I'm using software to record this podcast. You're using software to listen to it. We use software to connect with our friends, to play games, to move markets, to catch criminals. Software isn't eating the world. It's eating it. Professor McIlwain's book takes a hard look at the long relationship between the Black community in America and software. From the early pioneers building online communities in the dial-up era, he calls them the vanguard, to the relationship between software, the civil rights movement, and the police, all the way to today's social platforms, which amplify and distribute everything from TikTok dances to the Black Lives Matter movement. Now, I spend a lot of time thinking about software and culture. That's my job. And I was excited to talk to Professor McIlwain about how he sees that feedback loop between Black communities using software and what software gets made and how it gets made. And I've always been curious about why it seems like social platforms so quickly amplify Black culture and how those platforms might return some of that value to creators, which is not something that's happened historically. One thing to pay attention to in this conversation, and this feels like a lesson I just keep learning over and over again, is that while modern internet culture always feels new, like we're experiencing all of these problems for the first time, it really isn't. There are long patterns that stretch back across decades of people using computers and software to build communities and talk to each other. And we don't often stop and think about what we can learn from them. Maybe it's time we start. Okay, Dr. Charlton McIlwain, author of Black Software. Here we go. Charlton McIlwain, you're a professor of media, culture, and communication at NYU. Welcome to Decoder.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm really excited to talk to you. You wrote a book a few months ago called Black Software, The Internet and Racial Justice, which really tells a pretty big story about how Black people in the United States have actually been a part of networked communication from the beginning. They've been part of the tech industry. There's a pretty deep historical dive for the first half of the book. And the second half of the book connects all of that to what we've seen in this country over the past, I would say, year and a half with the Black Lives Matter movement, with the movement for racial justice, and how that has been largely expressed online. Give me a sense of how you began this project, because that is two very different stories. They feel connected, but each half of this book could be a book unto itself, really.
Indeed. And I think that represents kind of my journey in writing this book, which, for anyone out there who has written a book knows the strange anxiety of thinking about starting with a story that you think you know, pitching that to a publisher, getting a contract and a deadline, and then discovering somewhere along the way that it's a completely different story than you imagined. And that's kind of how this book went. It started off really narrow. I wanted to understand where Black Lives Matter came from. Here was a movement that seemed to come out of nowhere that had an impact that was, something that we hadn't really seen since literally the late 60s, early 70s, meaning their ability to produce sustained attention to issues of racism, racial justice, race in the criminal justice system, and have that atop the public agenda and to stay there for a period of time. So this all happened and it seemed to come out of nowhere. It seemed to very much be pushed by what people were doing online in social media spaces and other connected technologies, networked environments that they were working in to propel this movement. So I want to understand where it came from. I had at least enough sense to know that even though Black Lives Matter as a hashtag started in 2012, that there had to be something before our current moment that was a precursor, that was a push, that was a kind of foundation for Black Lives Matter to launch itself from. So that's where I really started this book. Where do we have that genealogy, that digital genealogy, network computing genealogy that would lead to this current moment? So that's where the book started. And from that beginning, as I started to find people, talk to people, this story started to move further and further back in time. It started kind of in the 90s, where I thought, this was my go-to. This is where we had the start of the internet as we know it, in the early 90s. And I got there. And number one, I found, an amazing group of people that I had never known about. And that was, a group of Black creators. Some of them were simply, hobbyists, some were engineers, some were lawyers, some teachers, etc., all of whom were in this digital space, creating content, networking across the country and the world through new computing tools and devices and so forth. So what they built through the 90s, I started to get a picture of that and had a sense of, wow, this is something I've never seen in the history of the internet, the history of civil rights, the history of Black invention. Nowhere have I seen these people. And so that started to become, a story that needed to be told. Somewhere through there, I met a man named William Morrell, and all of my conversations began the same way. I started off with a simple question that I thought I knew the answer to. When did you first get online? And, I knew the answer, right? It had to be 94, 93, maybe 92, for some. And I talked to William, and out of the gate, I asked a question. And he sort of just, I don't know. Well, let me think. And I'm thinking, what does this take? This can't be that hard. And finally, he said, I'd say we first went online in 78. And I remember having that moment of, what the hell do you mean by this? Was it mean to you to be online in 1978? And so eventually that story came out. But that was a push for me to say there is a story here that goes well beyond our current moment, well before the dawn of the internet as we know it, way back into the very earliest parts of computer networking, where Black people were very much connected and a part of that story. And yet that story had been largely untold. And I remember a very particular moment after William just sort of saying in my mind, if I'm already back to 78 in this question, in this part of history, I have a sense, and if I go back even further to that tumultuous moment of the 1960s, then I'm probably going to find a story that connects all these people. And sure enough, I did. And then ultimately, I felt the need to connect all of this, really, that moment of the 60s and what happened at the dawn of the computer revolution, at the height of the civil rights revolution, to what's happening today in terms of the fight for racial justice and somehow fit in everything in between.
Yeah, it's a lot. The book is a lot to take in. The sweep is incredible. One thing that I'm always focused on as I think about communications technologies broadly is that there's what the people who architected YouTube thought it would be, that it would be used in a certain way and for mostly good outcomes. And then there's what it is because of the people who use it, which can be really negative, but is also evolving. And those are radically divergent ideas.
Absolutely.
And often the conflict is expressed in things like moderation policies or free speech debates, which is sort of a negative expression. There's also a positive expression, which is that if you get it right, the people building the thing can see what the users are doing and they can build tools for them. And that feedback loop accelerates in really healthy and interesting ways.
Indeed.
One of the things I caught from the first part of your book that is back in time is that feedback loop almost didn't exist for the people you're describing, the graduate students who set up the first website for the Black Students Union, the people building the first Afrocentric message boards. Mm-hmm. They almost weren't seen in a way that the people building the software would accelerate their development. Why do you think that didn't happen? Because that, you know, you talk to somebody who runs a social service today or a social platform today, they are hyper aware that they need to be paying a lot of attention to their users, even if all I ask them about is moderation decisions. But like, they know the positive side of their equation is too. Why do you think that wasn't there at the beginning?
Well, I think there's a very peculiar story just about the invisibility of users generally, but Black folks specifically at that particular time, where, you know, simply we were not on the map in terms of computing development, network development, and certainly in that 70s, 80s build up to the commercial web, Black folks were not really a part of that story, not part of the sort of invention story in terms of being at, you know, embedded either in government research development centers or private enterprise or science and engineering institutions that were producing and making and building the actual hardware, software, etc. But the undercurrent of Black folks using these tools when they started to roll out, I think it was easy to just, those folks were so under the radar and not on the map of anyone thinking about, hey, we should pay attention to what these folks are doing, even if all they're doing is sort of tinkering around with things and playing and so forth. There wasn't a sense of a Black people's role or importance as a sort of a site of innovation or as a potential market later on as we move into the more commercial ends. So I think there was this sense of invisibility that led to the fact that, you know, there was no real reason and no sense of a needed feedback loop in the development of the internet and computing. The interesting point, though, on this that I see is that there is a moment where that doesn't end up being the case, meaning there's a moment towards the early days of the web where people did look back to and say, all right, now that we know this thing called the web, and now that we realize that it probably needs a lot of users, most of whom don't have a clue what the hell this technology could or should be used for, they did have a group of people to look back to just 2 or 3 years before. And that's where I think the folks in AfroNet who had built that bulletin board system of Black users came into play. And, you know, all the people that were playing in that world of the internet of the 88s and 89 and 90s. And what they saw was an ability for Black folks to, in the very least, produce community in those and through those networks. And I think it was interesting, certainly for me, to then see that as folks in 94, 95, 96 began to say, all right, how do we use this new tool? How do we bring people online? They looked to the AfroNets of the world and tried to mimic that pattern of creating a community in an online space and appealed to Black users to try to model that.
One of the major questions for the dominant social platforms and even some of the ones that are coming up is you have Black communities on your platforms. They are creating an enormous amount of culture. That culture becomes everyone's culture in the way that Black culture in America tends to become everyone's culture. And it's still like the value exchange still isn't there. I'm thinking specifically of Black Twitter, mm-hmm. right? The language of Black Twitter quickly becomes the language of the United States Senate in a way that makes no sense to me.
Right.
Like the words cancel culture came out of Black Twitter, and now white Republicans in the United States Congress said cancel culture is the biggest threat to America.
Yeah.
I don't know how that happened. I couldn't trace that pathway. At the same time, you have other smaller social networks like Clubhouse, which are trying not to make the same mistakes to their credit. Mm-hmm. They've started, they've given a lot of invites to prominent Black people and other people of color. They call them creators. They're going to try to pay them. But it still doesn't feel equitable that the exchange of the Black community, when it's distributed that easily and that quickly without any sense of value exchange, mm-hmm. the platforms themselves tend to just pull the value out and distribute them, collect that value, not bring it back to the communities it came from. How does that play? Has that gotten better? Am I describing a thing that has gotten progressively better or a thing that has stayed flat?
I think something that stayed flat. There's a very specific trajectory here, I think, and some of this is chronicled in the book up to a point, and that is I used to have a chapter in the book in an earlier version that was titled "Remember When the Internet Was Black," and it had everything to do with this moment in time from, let's say, about 1993 to roughly 98. When you looked out on the internet landscape of that day, whether it was through your large internet service providers like AOL or CompuServe and so forth, what you saw were businesses, properties, creators, many of whom were Black or part of the African diaspora, who had built profitable businesses in and through the new internet and that platform. And you could see not only what was being produced culturally, but you could see who was benefiting and profiting, and the ownership structure was very different for a very short period of time. And so to see that explosion of Black culture and Black ownership and value all at the same time was certainly, I think, a moment to be recognized and celebrated. But then, you know, come 98, 99, 2000, pretty much all of that is gone. And what you see that it is the story that is flat from that point on, in my opinion, is the continued recognition of the value of Black culture and Black cultural products, but without the critical elements of ownership and value or profit that comes back to Black creators, entrepreneurs, et cetera. And so that's the story that I think remains flat, that everywhere, as you mentioned, you see Black culture, you see the celebration of its of that culture, you see the ways in which Black culture powers social media platforms and everything else. But I don't think we've found the way to create real value in a sense of or a means by which Black folks largely stand to benefit from the profits of that. And, you know, I go back and forth to whether I'm optimistic or pessimistic about whether that'll ever happen. All I know is that it takes and will take an outsized level of capital and investment to make sure that that happens. And I'm, you know, a little wait and see to see if that actually materializes.
One of the stories in your book is about the early days of AOL and an executive at AOL who's actually sort of like a minor player in the story of The Verge, like off to the side, Ted Leonsis, who's a major executive at AOL. And he says, AOL is going to be built on communities. And he goes and spends money on a bunch of Black entrepreneurs to build communities, to integrate with AOL. Much later, the CEO of Vox Media, Jim Bankoff, my boss, was mentored by Ted Leonsis, right? And so I can see it. Okay, here's somebody who believed in communities. He mentored this guy, and now I work at the company that guy runs. Mm-hmm. What I don't see on the flip side is that other group of executives, I'm not ascribing anything to Ted, I think this is a structural problem. The other group of executives who were given the money, who were given the opportunity, they haven't started the next chain of businesses or platforms or internet companies. I'm wondering why you think that is, because from the jump, the opportunities look the same, right? Here's some money, build some community on this dominant networked platform. He was obviously trying to do it. He saw the opportunity, and that didn't leverage itself into the next thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, in part, you know, that's a critical recognition. There was something about that moment, and I do think that there was something about being able to see in that moment the value of Black cultural products as a sort of leader for this new wave of what this thing called the internet would become. And for someone like Ted to recognize folks like David Ellington and Malcolm Cassell and the team that built Net Noir and the things that came after, I think was a recognition of, if we want to jumpstart this, here's a market that we know is solid and that's there. And we know the value of Black culture. And I think that was the sort of key recognition from Ted when, you know, responding to folks like David, who say, look, we all know this. We know the world loves Black culture. So that first investment made sense when you had that configuration of users, markets, et cetera, at that moment in time. I do think that part of what happened as the 90s sort of came to a close, what also started to happen is that the internet starts to open up and we start to get a little bit more traction on the commercial potential and possibilities for this new thing. And my sense is simply that the sense of an existing market that would include and revolve around Black cultural products and producers evaporated when you start to see Black folks being a much more of a minority part of that growing internet market. So I think part of it was just a course correction in a sense that we know how markets are built. We know how capital is built in terms of who powers it, in terms of labor and so forth, and who generally stands to benefit. And I think that pattern then sort of kind of corrected and played itself out as the internet expanded in terms of users, expanded in terms of the types of commercial enterprises that began to connect. And I think it simply became much easier to say, we can do this and, you know, essentially exploit Black labor and production and profit in the ways that we've always have. That was the easy thing to do. The harder thing to do, which would have taken much more thought, deliberation, and effort, was how do we maintain this? And I think that's simply the question that, you know, apparently too few people ask themselves.
Do you think the platforms are doing a good job of reckoning with that now?
No.
Why not? What would you like to see?
I mean, I think, you know, I think a lot of it really for me comes back to this sense of value, right? So I still don't think that the platforms have figured out a way to say, we recognize and identify the ways in which Black cultural production is a unique value, added value to the platforms and how they work, you know, and Black Twitter could be, you know, one of those examples, and has not sort of planned for it in a way that makes it a part of the business structure, and a business structure that then says, you know, puts a monetary value in some ways on that, and then says, here's a way that we're going to take that monetary value and return it to those who have produced this value in some way. So I think, you know, some of the platforms have done things that are sort of on the outskirts of trying to, you know, create an environment that is, you know, free of trolls or things like that, and still make it an inviting place for Black folks and others to come and hang out in. But I don't think we've turned this corner in how do we flip, again, this notion of value such that those who are producing dividends for the platform also gets seen as in some way or have an ownership stake in that. And I think that's the big thing for platforms to wrestle with until, or at least when we, you know, we may have some platforms that are Black owned or minority owned that might look different.
I want to take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to talk to you about the other side of building software, which is making sure we do it responsibly. We'll be back.
Support for the show comes from the Harvard Business Review, the leading destination for smart management thinkers. You're a business leader, which means you have to deal with several different issues week after week. Look, it can be tough being the one calling the shots, but the Harvard Business Review can be a good place to help lighten the load on your shoulders. There's a lot of great stuff you can find at hbr.org, but for just $10 a month, you can get access to unlimited content, including insider newsletters, case studies, and the HBR mobile app. I had a chance to check out hbr.org, and let me tell you, the articles and case studies are very enlightening. Plus, you'll find podcasts, case studies, videos, newsletters, so much more. While much of Harvard Business Review's content is available for free after signing up at their site, subscriptions to unlimited content start at only $10 a month. Go to hbr.org/subscriptions and enter promo code DECODER right now to take advantage of this great offer. Again, go to hbr.org/subscriptions, enter promo code DECODER to learn more about this great opportunity to help manage your career and business.
Support for this podcast comes from Hims. It can be challenging for men to speak about their health, and whether that's a fear of being vulnerable or just wanting to keep things private, there are just some things we would just rather keep to ourselves. Hims knows how you feel, which is why they're looking to provide you the help you need discreetly. Hims is a men's healthcare brand looking to provide simple and convenient access to science-backed treatments for men. The entire process is 100% online, so you can get a new routine of improving your overall health in private. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free and in discreet packaging. No waiting rooms and no pharmacy visits. So while it can be tough to deal with this part of your life, it doesn't mean you have to do it alone. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/decoder. That's hims.com/decoder for your personalized treatment options. hims.com/decoder. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See hims.com/decoder for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
We're back, Professor McElwain. A big part of Black software focused on police software and where it started, where it came from, the networks that the police were using in the 70s and 80s. That obviously ladders right into the current moment. There's a national reckoning about surveillance and facial recognition that's taking place. We're seeing it with Capitol protesters who didn't realize how deeply they were being surveilled or didn't realize that their videos in Parler were able to be scraped.
Yeah.
Give me a sense of that arc, because I don't think enough people have looked into the past to figure out what we've already done with computers and policing in order to determine what we should do in the future.
Yeah. And I, you know, I think about this often, and my mind goes back to, I forget what the outlet was. It might've been ProPublica. It may have been a different source, but about 2 years ago who, you know, broke this story about the NYPD sharing its, you know, video surveillance system with IBM, and IBM's purpose was trying to build an AI system to power its facial recognition and identify criminal suspects based on the color of their skin. And I remember that reading that report, and, you know, the bombshell was, A, this is happening. And then the second one was, you know, this has been under wraps for 5 years that NYPD and IBM have been colluding to do this. And I remember just having a chuckle and thinking, wow, you guys really missed it. This was not a 5-year arc. It was a 50-year one, in very specific detail, and that is, it's in terms of the relationship between NYPD and IBM. But more broadly for me, that arc, you know, signaled something for me, which was a realization that for all the conversation that we're having right now about the devastation of surveillance technologies and others utilized in criminal justice, that this is not a new question, and that we have been here for a very long time. And that to me said two things. Number one, it should give us pause. And what to me should give us pause is that origin story of computing technology, where the first uses of the computer was to essentially devastate Black people and Black communities. And the realization that that was, you know, unlike today, where everybody's sort of running from, and, you know, your tech companies and so forth are like, you know, save me from the bad PR of the impact this is having on these communities. Being in a moment of time in history where everybody was very clear and explicit that we have a threat. That threat is in our urban areas. It's Black people who are Black, brown, generally poor, and they are protesting in the streets. They are fighting. We see them as the face of crime and violent behavior. We need to use our technological powers to curtail their ability to thwart the nation's order, economic order, racial order, power, etc. So to see that realization very explicitly powering the first uses of our computational systems, I think.
I just want to be clear. You're talking about in the 60s and the 70s.
Correct.
The end of the civil rights era. The Watts riots figure prominently in your book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So those moments where, you know, at the height of the civil rights movement, you're also beginning this crest of computing technology development and the widespread thinking about the future of computing. What is this going to mean for us now and in the future? And so it's always hit me that, you know, that was a moment where there was a decision point, right? Here we have this great power that comes with computing. We could have very well said, you know, how can we use the power of computing to help spearhead economic equality at a moment in time when that was clearly a thing of great concern? But our minds went to what our preeminent problem was at that time, which had everything to do with race, that had everything to do with Blackness and Black communities. And then we built our computing systems to fit the problem as it looked then. And I think what has persisted is that problem has not changed, or our framing of that problem has not changed. And so from the 60s, 70s, 80s, up to our current point, we still frame the problem of crime and criminality in terms of Blackness and brownness. And therefore, our computing systems have followed that same developmental pattern and trajectory, where now we're seeing really the sort of end stages, if you will, or the full fruition of things that were really just germinating in 1966, 67, 68, when these first systems began to be built.
Give me an example of something that's come to fruition.
I mean, facial recognition has been an outgrowth of that. And the facial recognition has been an outgrowth of the ability and desire to profile criminal suspects, right? So this has everything to do with, quote unquote, prevention of crime, as it was framed in 1965, as much as it is now, right? How do we prevent crime? Well, we try to understand who's most likely to commit those crimes and where and what they look like and what their MO is. And so the more data we have to tell us and give us a profile of that person, the more we can use police resources, whether that's manpower or technological powers, to identify police and then constrain that. And so I think that impulse to be able to predict and therefore solve a problem because you're able to predict the causes and antecedents of that criminal behavior. And so facial recognition as a fruition of an initial impulse that was really just about tracking people. And of course, in 1968, what we had was a physical description that is part of these systems, right? Who, what your race is, what your color, your eyes, your hair, skin, etc. are, and to as great detail as possible. And so facial recognition becomes another layer that is even better than having a description of someone. Now I have the image of that person along with a description to match. And so that's why I say in many in many ways, that facial recognition technology is the full fruition of an impulse that starts in the early mid-60s to say, how do we identify and visualize and locate people who are predisposed to commit crime? And then how do we mobilize police resources to thwart them? And so that then, I think, has prepared or framed the evolution of policing technology ever since. And I think what has persisted during that whole arc as well, of course, is the position and framing and prejudices around Black and brown people as a perpetual source of crime and criminality.
Right. The predictive policing system is a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? It says the data says the Black and brown people are going to do crimes. The cops go there.
And lo and behold, I find some crime.
They found some crimes and on we go. The hard question there, and I've really struggled with this, is we do want the cops to be effective. And the cops want computers. And they say the computers are what's going to help them be more effective and more targeted and maybe make better use of limited resources. Right. There's a natural argument here, right? Like, I want to do a better job at my homework. Mom, buy me a computer so I can do my homework better. But you can extend that to, I want to be more productive at my job. Automation and computing technology can help me be more productive and more accurate. What is it about the police so specifically where it's just that feedback loop? What breaks that feedback loop?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that goes wrong often, and I think, you know, maybe even peculiarly in criminal justice and in policing, is, you know, there's a recognition that this is hard, right? Policing is hard. The stakes are high. But then there's this jump to what seems to be an easy solution. And I think the connection and the idea and the sort of dream that the technology is always more efficient and easier and allows us to do our jobs better in terms of police has somehow become ingrained in that thought to where it's the technology that drives this story and not policing per se, or not policing that says, look, everything that we want to do is done in the service of safety, ideally in the service of justice. And we know how complicated that is, right? So just imagine a world where we're not even thinking about technology and just thinking about policing, and policing where you have two ideals, safety and justice, right? And good people who are in roles that they're in to do good things, and that is keep people safe, do so in a just way, meaning there's no disparate impact on certain people more than others. We're not targeting certain people more than others. We're trying to keep people safe generally across the board equally. And then, of course, we can't extract then those two things that I think have, again, over a long arc of time, become conjoined. Number one, that Black and brown folks are overly represented as criminals. And so it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy that then gets mired into and really directs police use of computing systems, number one. But the other is this over-reliance on the technology and the belief that just because it's a technological solution, it is better. A colleague of mine named Meredith Broussard coined this term she calls techno-chauvinism, and it's really about that. The idea that technology, a technological system, is in and of itself useful, important, and has value. But I always go back to that same moment in 64, 65, 66, and so forth, where if you went into a police station and said, hey, we've got this new technological tool, you are more likely than not to have officers say, to hell with that. I don't need that. I do a perfectly good job knowing who it is I see out on the street, the relationships I have with people, the connections that I have. And sure, I may still do certain things wrong. I still may have certain prejudices that lead to different kinds of outcomes. But you know what? I don't need your technology. And to see that story flip from that point up to now, where the predilection is to say, this database is more effective in telling me whether this individual person or this set of people are likely to have committed this crime, then my own good sense or my own skills as a police officer, being part of a community and being able to put two together that says, maybe this person seems like a suspect, but is not likely. I'm much more predisposed to just trusting this system that says, hey, these five people in this dragnet because of a combination of their location and location data and their facial recognition and other characteristics tells me, you know, I should go show up at their house to arrest them. So I think there's something about that loop that has not been interrupted and that has now become so ingrained in policing that says the technology is always better. I don't need to question it. I don't need to question its outcomes. I don't even need to question the motives for which it was made. And the fact of the matter is, I think if you ask a lot of police officers to go in and explain to you the technologies they use and rely on, many of them won't be able to tell you or explain to you how those technologies work. It's a simple, I push some buttons, it gives me a suspect, my job is easier, I go and do what I've got to do. And you know, many of the disparate outcomes that make these things so controversial and unjust, I think come a lot from just that simple over-reliance on a technology and a technological solution for problems that are much more complex.
Let me put that idea into tension with what we were talking about with communities online. One of the good things about platforms like Twitter and Facebook and TikTok and YouTube is that Black people are just more visible. They're able to communicate more broadly. There are less gatekeepers, fewer intermediaries. Black culture is, right, it just quickly becomes the dominant culture. That is very human. That's very humanizing, right? We're just able to see each other more, no matter what community you're in.
Mm-hmm.
You have something to say and people are into it, that you can be found. And that is a remarkable quality of the modern platforms, regardless of all their other ills. On the flip side, you're saying the police are getting more and more dehumanized from the communities they serve because of technology. That seems like a really core tension to the modern era.
Absolutely. I mean, it's that technology produces the distance. And, you know, just thinking about the things that you can deduce from being out on a street corner versus staring at a screen with a variety of streams of data that tell you what's purporting to be going on that same street corner, right?
But aren't those same cops on TikTok and Twitter and marinating in this larger culture? And why doesn't that get itself resolved?
Yeah, I mean, they are, but they may be as private citizens. But again, when the question becomes, am I using this platform as a place of, you know, this is where I live, this is where I play, et cetera, the moment it becomes, this is where I do my work of policing and crime. And so therefore, there's a problem motive that permeates my engagement with that space. And now I'm seeing everything as, you know, basically potential suspects. And this is what has happened with the encroachment of police and policing into the platform arena, where, you know, the disconnect is between, you know, folks who are there saying, look, I'm just living life and I'm doing things that give me enjoyment or having fun. I'm not policing myself in terms of who I'm talking to. And so the same things might play out in that space as may play out if I were out on the street, but simply as an ordinary way of doing life. But then when I've got cops then coming into this space and saying, I'm here to find people who have broken the law, may have broken the law in some way, and enforces a surveillance lens around that, an enforcement lens around that, then all of a sudden, everyone becomes in some way a suspect at the moment there's a precipitating problem. And all of a sudden, that innocent thing I said that probably sounds crass or crude, maybe even violent, becomes evidence for me to use in a criminal investigation against you, whether or not you actually participated in a crime or not. And so, you know, the social media and what plays out there becomes a point of criminality in some ways, differently than how you would make sense of things or how you would do police work if most of your work was out on the street, embedded in the networks of people that you are. It gives you a different kind of discretion to check yourself, right? There are different things that you know. If I'm out on the street and the people I see and how things work, how people have conversation, who interacts with whom, there's a different kind of sensibility that allows my decision making to operate very differently than if I'm removed from those people and now there's distance and I don't know these people out on the street. I know them through their Facebook persona or their Twitter handle or what have you. And again, it's just further removed, further possibilities of sort of abstractly thinking about human beings being disconnected from the humanity of folks who are on those platforms.
We're going to take another break. When we come back, I want to talk about the creator economy and representation when it comes to building platforms.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline. Because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
All right, we're back with Charlton McElwain, author of Black Software. Here's a hard question that I struggle with all the time. Why do we all work for Twitter for free? I do it. Yeah. You do it. You know, I looked at your Twitter account before I came on. You work for free a couple times a day. I work for free way too many times a day. Why is it just we're being seen and that is the value and that's the incentive? Is there something that can break that cycle where we're all creating value for free? Because that to me is the heart of it, right? Like, it can get as inequitable as you want. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I still wake up and I'm like, got to send some tweets for free.
Right. I mean, it's such a hard thing. And, you know, it's hard for me to know whether, you know, this was very specifically a kind of a deliberate forethought sort of plan. But the truth of the matter is that the platforms have done well as creating a sense of value for all of us that now it becomes something that we are so connected to that becomes part of our sort of personal infrastructure, if you will. If I've got something to say, I've got nobody to talk to, particularly in a moment like this. Nobody's going to listen to me, but I've got Twitter. So what am I going to do? You know, I'm going to try to say what I have to say. And I know I have an audience and this thing has created the possibility for me to have that audience. Right. So I work for free because in some ways I see some value that trickles back to me. It may not be monetary in nature. I may not be able to calculate it in terms of dollars and cents, but I do see some personal value. That's me. I'm not saying that probably most users see it that way, who just sort of go and do their thing because this is a place to do their thing. But there, I think that's the kind of grip. And then what you really need to do if you were to shut something like that down is to flip the switch and say, I'm done. I'm off. I'm not playing the game anymore. And, you know, the risks of that are sort of twofold. Number one, I don't get that small sense of value that existed there for me. All right, where's my audience now? I got to go try to build that on my own or give up having a voice in a way. The second part is Twitter might just say, who the hell cares? We will go on without you. Thank you very much for your service, your labor, everything you provided for us. Sorry you're going, but we'll find people like you elsewhere in the future and continue to make money. So I think it's, we all work for free because we find some value in what the platforms have created. I think if we are to get to some place where there's not this constant tension about how this plays out on particular platforms and the direction that things take, is a mutual recognition and an equitable recognition of, all right, I do things that produce value for the platform, and I also gain value from something that the platform has produce for me, an infrastructure for me to work and play and do all these other kinds of things in. And so some kind of reckoning that makes sure the labor to value exchange there has some equity built into it. And I'm not so sure that that's the case when we look at the large scale financial value that a platform gets out of drawing on our sort of mass labor. And what we get as an individual from sort of playing in that sandbox.
Well, the reason I ask is, one, I just want somebody to tell me to stop working for free, honestly. And but more broadly, to connect to your thesis and your book, you're describing a moment early on in the history of computing when big companies like IBM, big universities like Clemson, would build pipelines for minorities to come join the workforce, get skills, train up, do all those things. Then in the 90s, there's a point where you describe them as the vanguard, where they actually stand to own the products, where they stand to make a lot of money because they've built communities. They were early. That moment goes away as the platforms and the broader internet dominates. And that's kind of where we are now. But the other half of your book and your thesis and where you began was, well, there's Black Lives Matter. Right, there's the ability for the community to harness the tools and say, look at this injustice. And I think maybe for the individual, there's no obvious equitable value there. I'm not getting paid to be outraged. Mm-hmm. But for the community, there's a massive amount of value that's being generated, a massive amount of attention and potentially political and cultural change. How should we balance that?
I think we have to do what, Black folks and people of color and marginalized folks have always done in those situations, which is extract value from what we've been given. Number one, we don't own those platforms. We didn't build them, but we can utilize them, and we can figure out how to utilize them both for our individual sort of pleasure, but also thinking about sort of communal interests and ways that would serve those interests. And I think that's the story you saw playing out with Black Lives Matter and many other instances. So I think we have to do that on the one hand, but at the same time, I think we have to still fight for what we so long have not had, which is that sense of ownership, our ability to build our own thing, our own way for our own purposes and to our own ends. And I think that's really what's been the missing piece of the puzzle. A question I often, get asked is, is it viable to have, the next Twitter that is Black owned or is minority owned and so forth? Is it viable to have a Black Twitter that is a Black Twitter? And I think, it's an interesting question that I think needs to happen, because I think, the circumstances and the pitfalls with platforms as they exist, which we've seen so many times, even with something as powerful and impactful as Black Lives Matter, is everything is still contingent, right? I'm not sure if this is my place where I'm organizing and pushing for these things and having great visibility and outcome. I don't know that it's going to exist continuously. I don't know if the owners of the platform are someday going to decide that particular features of the platform are shut down or cut off, that then doesn't afford me the same opportunities to gain visibility and engagement in those same ways. I cannot assume that the powers that be, law enforcement, etc., won't sort of stake these places out for surveillance in the ways that they have over the last few years, and then essentially turn this into a platform that's really not a place I can go to and count on to do this kind of work that pushes forward the interest of me and my community and all those things. And so I think we have to play the game in the spaces that we are able to and gain a foothold there, transform them in the ways that we can. But I think we still have to push for that, you know, dream that we've seen unrealized all too often, which is the ability to own, shape, develop something that truly is molded, not only in terms of our culture, but in terms of our interest in the both the immediate and long-term outcomes that it delivers.
Let me give you a small example of like a creator economy story that I think is really interesting. There's Versus, which Swizz Beatz in Timbaland, they start in the pandemic just live streams of all of their famous friends talking about their music, playing their music. And it's supposed to be a battle, but it's not really a battle. It's just like a cool hang. And they have leveraged this from like a thing they were doing on Instagram Live all the way to a business that is now going to run the Pro Bowl for the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
In my understanding of Swizz Beatz and Timbaland is they are not bad at business. I assume they're being paid handsomely for this franchise that mm-hmm. exists now that they can take in all these places, monetize in all these different ways. Why isn't that a more common story, right? Is it just because they already happen to be famous and they already happen to have the business infrastructure and the connects and they, you know, Jay-Z is the guy in charge of culture for the NFL, so they probably just made it. Like, is it just those are natural built-in advantages, or is it that this system, like systematically, we don't want those things to happen, right? Like, because there are lots of people online who build cool products that have a big mm-hmm. audience on the platforms. And the second they try to take them off the platform or monetize directly or sell it again, mm-hmm. all kinds of bad things happen.
Yeah, I do think there's a sense in which, you know, people have different starting points. So, you know, Versus has a starting point that is much higher than your average entrepreneur who has a good idea and maybe has a good prototype of a product and so forth. And that missing piece is, you know, in my mind, that connection to a network of contacts, resources, capital, et cetera, that's already embedded for someone who is a celebrity, who's already producing in another sphere and, you know, transforming something into another. I think that's what we're losing out on, because that group of people is small, relatively, right? We have a much expansive base when you look at people of color who are entrepreneurs and creators and so forth and have great ideas. But what they don't have is the access to those areas of capital and power, the networks that says, all right, for me to go from here to here, I need this, this, and this, and be able to know, all right, I get that from this person and get an introduction to that person, or have three or four people that can say, oh, I know what you need here. I can make sure you get it from these folks over here. And so I think that's where we're losing out, because our eyes are always pitched at those who already have access, right? So it's easy for these folks to just say, hey, here's my folks I go to for money, for ideas. When someone recognizes what I'm doing, they come to me to ask me to do something else. So that's already there. We don't have too many folks that are looking below and looking at all the talent that's out there in the world and saying, oh, I recognize what could be possible if I see what you're doing and elevate what it is that you're doing in all these different ways, whether that's capital or connections or a wider network and so forth. And so I think sometimes I like to pitch it differently than just thinking about, you know, sort of the nefarious forces that say, you know, we don't want you playing here. And I certainly think that's obviously real in a sense of it. But I think so much more of it is simply our laziness in almost some ways to sort of say, let me do something different. Let me look in a different direction and see if I find different people and ideas worth investing in and backing and pushing, because because the ideas are great and better, because the people who are pushing and producing them are different and are liable to bring something very different to the table, we tend to just simply say, look, we know this works, so let me look for that same thing in a very different way, but the same thing over and over and over again. And we tend to have this sense about, you know, the same thing, being able to count on it, being reliable, and we miss out on so much that's out there and untapped in the world of Black and brown folks who are, you know, who are ready to sort of move into this territory, who do have ideas, who have produced, who do have experience. And, you know, often we simply say, these people don't exist out there. None of them has cropped my desk. No one's showed up in my office somehow. But it's because, you know, we haven't looked. And that's really the reason.
You know, we did an episode of Decoder with a woman named Arlen Hamilton, a VC who runs a venture capital firm called Backstage Capital. They're focused on investing in underrepresented founders. And I asked her, are you afraid of the tech giants? And she said, well, no, they're not looking where I'm looking. And every other tech executive in VC is terrified of the tech giants because they are all looking in the same place. And it's interesting to connect those two answers, right? And to say, well, there's actually a world of opportunity. We just have to build the network to create value out of it.
Exactly.
I guess what I would ask you is, isn't that, you know, I'm like a capitalist at heart. Isn't that a better solution, right, to focus on building that network and elevating the people and giving them access to tools than, I don't worry that Jack Dorsey is going to hire the right three Black people to build the next features of Twitter? Like, because that is a solution I do hear about all the time, that inside the big tech companies, there's not enough representation. I don't think there is, but that feels like a narrow time box solution. And honestly, you're still just betting on three individuals to get it right, no matter what, who they are. Right. And that to me, like, it needs to be connected to that much bigger idea. And I'm wondering if you see that bigger idea taking form.
Yeah, you know, I think in some way there's this disconnect, you know, particularly in the sort of the capitalist landscape where there's supposed to be so much faith in the market, not to go look into the actual market to see that there's a whole sense of possibilities out there and ignore them. And I don't know whether it's, you know, simple obstinance or, you know, risk aversion, but I do think there is a sense that, you know, if we're going to have real innovation and not just continue to just sort of replicate the same thing over and over with a new twist, then you gotta, you know, 180 and completely look and play in a different pool. And so, you know, there's always this sort of talk about, you know, kind of the representation when we talk about tech companies, as you mentioned, you know, and the number of Black and brown folks that are at a Facebook or a Twitter or what have you. And, you know, that is important. I think it's important to have critical masses of those folks across the board of those companies, and particularly in leadership. But I don't think that's the solution, because you're still within an umbrella that says, this is what we do. And everything that you do is in the service of what we do. We got to have a lot more people thinking about what it is we do and can do out there. And I think the more we invest in that sort of wide diversity of possibilities, you know, it's I'm blown away and was blown away in writing Black Software and looking at the sort of the power and ingenuity of Black folks at that particular moment. I work every day, you know, with students, and you just see the amazing possibilities that are there, the kinds of ideas, the kind of people that come through. And it's like, I can't even write the story of what could be, other than knowing that if people look around and look elsewhere and invest in those possibilities, I mean, it's bound for something amazing to come out of that. And so I think that kind of spreading of the wealth, as it were, in terms of investing in new ideas, new people, new networks, I think that's the next big thing. And the person who realizes and figures out how to harness that new area where nobody's looking is going to, you know, build something special and probably profit a good deal as a result.
So let me end here, because this is, I think, the biggest question of our moment in the pandemic. You and I are talking to each other through software. Our lives are more and more mediated by screens. But, you know, ideally, halfway through the year, a lot of people will be vaccinated.
we're going to get away from our computers. We're going to go back to life, regular life in some way. What do you think our relationship with software will be like? Not just for Black folks, which is what your book is about, but it feels like all of our relationships to software and screens and platforms have changed in this pandemic year. We're all thinking about it more. We're all demanding more. What is the change you hope to see when we go back and I can interview you in person again?
I mean, I think at least one thing that will come out of it is a much more deep reflection of and understanding what screens and mediated contexts are good for and what they're not. I think above all things, I hope we get out of this the very value of face-to-face communication. And again, I think we're finding that it's, maybe not completely necessary for everything, but I think we're starting to see when it's missing and the implications of when we cannot have that kind of contact. And I think to be human is to be together physically, to be able to interact and engage and see and engage all of our senses in a way that can't be done on a screen. And so so part of what comes out of this is a renewed commitment to just thinking about what makes us human and how we build our lives around maximizing our ability to connect as human beings and understand that the deep humanity that is at the root of all of us.
What do you think is going to happen to our relationship with software?
I mean, I don't think it'll change.
Like, I want to throw my phone out the window. It's right. I'm done with it.
I don't think it'll change much. I think software has a grip on everything that we do that I don't think is going to be undone in this moment. In fact, it's probably going to work its way into more facets of our lives. I think, the ways in which, probably you, certainly I and many others, saw the evolution of email years ago and how much that bound us to longer times for working and so forth. The productivity of screens, I think we're starting to see that, and the encroachment of the screen on our space, on work, on home, on life. There will be companies that say, you know what? I don't think you have to come back into work anymore. That screen is just fine and it's much cheaper. And so more and more lives that are lived on the screen, mediated through software that constricts what it is that we can do, whether you're on a Zoom platform or a Microsoft Teams, and the software has dictated how you can interact and with how many people you can comfortably interact. And so I don't know. I don't think it's going to go in the direction of freeing us from software. I don't think it's going to go in the direction of a less reliance on technological tools that drive everything that we do.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to try to stop working for free and not throw my phone out the window.
Let's all make that a goal, right?
All right, Professor McElwain, that was terrific. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you again to Professor Charlton McElwain for taking the time to talk today, and thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, I'd love to hear what you think of the show. You can email us at decoder@theverge.com or hit me up directly. I'm @reckless on Twitter. If you like the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Decoder is a production of The Verge and part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today's episode was produced by Sophie Erickson and Andrew Marino. Our music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. We'll see you next week.